You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
Over 7 million different animals inhabit our planet.
But when you think about kangaroos that live in trees, this is the species. And I remember the ones at John's Zoo. I remember my students back in the day doing research with one of those babies.
What can they teach us?
The Matchy's tree kangaroo is actually the best vertical climber and has more strength for doing this than a lot of the other species of tree kangaroos.
Many species are in crisis and need your help. Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.
Welcome to Our Creatures Podcast. This is Chris.
And I'm Angie.
And this is a one, tree kangaroos. You've been for a few years, honestly. It's been a species on your target that for some reason we never got to it till 2024 for some reason.
I know, but I'm so excited today to talk about another marsupial, right? In the family Macropodiae, which means Bigfoot. So yes, I have not worked with tree kangaroos, but I'm very inspired, and we'll have hopefully some good social media footage this week or in the next few weeks to come, because they have the Matchy's tree kangaroo at the Santa Fe College Teaching Zoo, where my handsome husband works. And so I see them, I mean, a couple times a month when I'm taking the boys after school. We just go there. They have their female. Her name is Adelaide. She has had several joeys that stay with her for a long time, and we'll talk all about that when we get to the reproduction section. But seeing a tree kangaroo joey, its head out of the mom's pouch, is one of the most wonderful sights there is. I sent you that picture, right, before we started today? One that famous photographer Joel Sartori took. They're just so cool. They're such a cool species. And, of course, marsupials are near and dear to my heart. When I was a zookeeper, I got to work with possums, the only North American marsupial. And when I was at the zoo, I also worked with red kangaroos. So that was super fun. I learned a lot working with them as a zookeeper. And of course, today we're going to talk all about the difference between regular kangaroos from Australia, ground-dwelling, big, strong, and the tree kangaroo is very different. Very, very, very different. Closely related, more or less, on the taxonomical tree of life, but yeah, different. And they hang out in trees, and they're from Papua New Guinea, which, I have like two slides on Papua New Guinea itself, just because, yeah. Oh my gosh, it's on my bucket list. I think you're going eventually, right?
We are planning on possibly going in June, so I will keep you informed. It was an area on Earth I've always wanted to go, but I know in a previous podcast, we talked about the dangers of going to New Guinea. And so talking to Jesse, if you really want to do birding, he said, go to the Indonesia side of New Guinea. But I'm going to be doing some of the islands off New Guinea later in the year. So I'm very excited because it's all in my back door. And it's, you know, the tree kangaroo, they are found in Australia too, in North Queensland. And I was just in Queensland a few weeks back, not that far north, because it's such a massive territory. Australia is massive. It's just massive, and loved every minute there. Love the people, love the food, love the weather. And I didn't get that far north, north of Cairns and above there, but I definitely want to get up to that part of Australia eventually. But when you think about kangaroos that live in trees, this is the species. And I remember the ones at John's Zoo. I remember my students back in the day doing research with one of those babies, and they were looking at affiliative behavior, you know, maternal behavior. They were studying that with just a class project. So, you know, those animals are very near and dear to my heart. And then the other important thing, Angie, is their conservation story. These are almost all the species are endangered. Some are data deficient. We just don't know because they are in New Guinea and Papua New Guinea. There's places you don't want to go. But the species we do know, you know, critically endangered, endangered, this is a species that could go extinct. You know, there's 14 of them. A lot of them could go extinct. We could lose these animals. They're that close to the brink. So it's important that we understand them. Where do they live? You know, what's their habits? All of that. And what we can do to protect them.
Yeah. I mean, the Machi's tree kangaroo, which is what they have at the Santa Fe College Teaching Zoo, that species, there's only about 2,500 individuals left in the wild. And as you mentioned, that's a rough estimate. And so the IUCN labels them as endangered. And that's why several zoos in North America are participating in the Species Survival Plan, the SSPs, and keeping those numbers of Machi's tree kangaroos going, living under human care. And we'll talk about more of that too throughout the podcast, because there is a lot of awesome work that zoos are doing to make people more tree kangaroo aware, because probably several people listening to this podcast had no idea that there was such a species as a tree kangaroo. They're really, really a cool species. So I hope you stick around today to learn all these fun facts. It's going to be a good pod.
It's interesting you bring that up too. When you look at the 14 species, there's a species that 13, 14, one that kind of straddles the line, they think of being a tree kangaroo. But when you look at their status, I've got near threatened, vulnerable, near threatened, vulnerable. Only two of the 14 where we have data on them are they least concerned, meaning there's a healthy population there. But the one you mentioned, endangered, critically endangered, endangered, then data deficient. So I'll go through the list.
And yeah, and these are species, not even subspecies, like different colors, different traits. So yeah, it's important that we keep our eye on them.
Well, and the Wandaway is the one that's the most endangered. They think maybe 50 left in the wild. They think it might be extinct. So we'll talk about that today. Before we get going real quick, shout out to Abigail, Montana State. She reached out. I did a personal interview with her. She's actually from back in my hometown in California. But I just want to say, keep at it, Abigail. She wants to work in conservation. It was, you know, things that we talk about in the podcast, but also what we ask our interviewees, you know, that we sit and talk with all these conservation experts. Where did you get started? So for the young budding conservationists listening to this podcast, go back and look at some of these scientists we talked to. One of the first questions we ask is, give us your background. How did you get to where you're at? You know, when you go with a Chris Fisher who is out there tagging great white sharks and, you know, is on Animal Planet or Shark Week or all these shows that he's out there doing, to somebody like Sunarto, who we always talk about, who's going looking for tigers in Indonesia. So, you know, listen to their stories and it should give you some inspiration. I mean, we've done 100, 150 interviews in this podcast. I know it's a really healthy list, and you can go and listen to them tell their stories, and hopefully it gives you some inspiration. And then I just also want to say thank you to our Patreon subscribers. We will be sending money out after I learn which organization Angie picks today to support Tree Roos.
Yes, and I want to give a big shout out to Wint Cat Boo, who gave us a glowing review on iTunes, mentioning that they love listening to our podcast while they walk their dog and their baby. So congratulations on that. I'm a huge fan of listening to podcasts too. When I walk with the dog, I should say dogs, we have a foster fail that we're adding to our house. So stay tuned for those details coming soon on social media. But at any rate, thank you for listening and thank you for reviewing Wint Cat Boo. And if you do like our podcast, if you want to go ahead and show your support by subscribing and reviewing us on iTunes, giving us 5 stars, that would be awesome. We don't have any for the month of February yet, so you could be the first, and I'll give you a shout out, and we really appreciate it.
No, we do. We do. Thank you so much. And, you know, we talk about tree kangaroos, Angie. 14 species. Actually, I forgot to mention this too. In 1990, they discovered a new species of tree kangaroo, the golden mantled tree kangaroo in Papua New Guinea. So thinking of discovering new species, that's a pretty big mammal.
Yes. But again,
it tells you how remote Papua New Guinea is in the mountains and what species might still be up there that we haven't found yet that could be a larger mammal like a tree kangaroo. But leading into that, which one did you want to describe? And then I'll kind of go through the list and talk about how some of them are a little bit different.
Sure. Well, of course, I'm going to pick the Machu's tree kangaroo. It's also known as a Huon tree kangaroo. This is because it's native to the Huon Peninsula in northeastern New Guinea, within the nation of Papua New Guinea. So the Machu's is stunning. It's a beautiful kangaroo. Its colors are just impeccable. And so it has to be noted that the Machu's tree kangaroo, and I think several of the species, they have this really dense, thick, wool-like fur, which considering Papua New Guinea is tropical, is interesting. We'll talk more about that when we get into adaptations of the tree kangaroo throughout the millennia. But yeah, they have this dense, thick fur, and it can vary in coloration, but in general, it's from reddish brown to dark brown all over their whole body. But they do have some beautiful counter shading on their arms, their chest, belly, and then their hind feet and tail. And that's going to be a light golden color, almost yellow. It can be anywhere from like yellow to tan, sometimes even creamy white. But it's just beautiful because it makes their arms and legs different color. And then their tail really stands out. And when you zoom into the face of the Machu's tree kangaroo as well, their faces are like a cross between a regular kangaroo, but then also they have a more like maybe like a bear. They have like a snout, a longer snout than a typical kangaroo. And it ends in a boop of a pink nose, which is just, it's a very boopable nose. In fact, that it's bigger, and it's also, their face is the dark brown, reddish brown color, but they also have some of that yellow cream tan color around their eyes and muzzles. It really just makes their muzzle pop. They have darling teddy bear-like ears, so the smaller ears, large claws, which we'll talk a lot about for tree climbing, for clasping and going up and down the trees. And then their tail is very long, and they do use it a lot to help give the balance. And once again, we'll talk more about that. So they're just, their fuzzy little yellow feet are, I have like 16 pictures. Or then I took some of like the Joey and the mama's pouch. And of course, they have a pouch. They're a marsupial. We'll talk a lot about that in reproduction. The females have that in their, a lower abdomen region, which really isn't obvious from a photo unless, once again, there's a Joey present inside it.
Well, and the thing that gets you, tree kangaroos, these are, I would say, wallaby size.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we did the red kangaroo. We haven't done the grays yet, or we haven't really covered a wallaby. You know, smaller, you're thinking 20 to 30 pounds or upwards of 14 kilograms. Body lengths up to the larger ones, 75 centimeters, 30 inches. So not, you know, two and a half feet tall. Mm-hmm. And then their tails, you know, another 2 feet, almost 3 feet, up to 30 inches or 75 centimeters. So if you think of kangaroos, when I think of kangaroos, I always think of the reds because they're the big boys and girls. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that are like stacked. You see all the photos and they're, you know, hopping around. They're massive. And then when you think of wallabies, you think of small kangaroos. That's kind of what the tree roo size when you go through the 14 different species. Now, they do range in New Guinea, which we've been talking about. So there is Papua New Guinea, and then there's the Indonesian side of New Guinea. So if you look at the island or surrounding islands, that's where I hope to go in a few months. The eastern half is Papua New Guinea. The western half is part of Indonesia, New Guinea. So the tree roos are all over Indonesia. And then just in the north tip of Queensland in the Dane tree.
I did not know that. That's awesome. Yeah.
And the two species that are in Australia is the Lumholtz tree kangaroo and then the Bennett's tree kangaroo. So they're near Cairns, which I've been to, Pip's been to, beautiful part of Australia. I really want to get back up there. The Daintree rainforest, that I saw this many years ago when I first went to Australia, when I was still living in the States. Beautiful part of the country. I was just before we got started, I'm trying to convince Angie to come over to this part of the world. She wants to go to Africa. I'm trying to get her to Australia, New Zealand.
I mean, you're giving a simple summary. I want to do both. In a pinch, if I had to pick which one. Oh, but you were coming with me. So that it wasn't just go to Africa with your family.
Yeah.
And, but it was either where should we all go with our families? And if we had to pick, should it be Australia or Africa? So maybe we'll just put a poll on social media. Yeah. But yes, I am very excited to get to Australia. Asia in general is on my bucket list. So yeah.
We'll do both.
My heart in Africa. I just feel like I belong there.
I know.
Just the other day, we'll do both.
This is what we're going to do. We're going to do an all creatures trip. We're going to plan it in the works. I know we're talking about our friend Corbin Maxey's going to Africa with followers of him. And I think Angie and I would love to like plan a trip with some of our listeners and end up in both. So maybe we'll manifest that. We'll put it out to the universe and get the ball rolling on thinking about it. And then we can start planning it. And then in 10 years when our kids are older, no, we go sooner than that. But it's just something to think about, because Angie, you would love the Daintree. I want to go see cassowary, but that's way up. We probably have to go to Darwin for that. But you know, but then there's things in Australia I don't want to see. You know, I'd like to see, you know, like the behind glass, some of the snakes there and stuff. But
well, yeah. And I would love to snorkel or dive the Great Barrier Reef. So that that's would be life-changing. Exactly. So many things to do. Yes, we have to manifest all of that. But I don't know why the other day I just was really like thinking hard about the Rhino Orphanage. And I was thinking, you know, I should it'd be a good trip to bring my kids there for a volunteering vacation to help show them different countries.
You could sell me on that if there's the elephant orphanage nearby, or they have some baby elephants.
I need to get some of those people on the podcast. I don't know if they're nearby, but we could do both. And I think it'd be great to show my kids, obviously, the culture of Africa, the different countries, and then of course wildlife in the wild and how we need to help support them and save them. So, and then also then I would get to feed baby rhinos.
Well, I'm
a little self-serving.
Our Australia fans, I'll get her over. I love Aussie. Yeah. I love Brisbane. I'm going, Sydney soon. And it's just in my back door.
Well, you could probably talk me into like a wildlife rehab in Australia as well.
Feeding Lone Pine. We were going to go to Lone Pine. I was going to go to Lone Pine this last trip. I just couldn't fit it in. But there in Brisbane, where I just remember us doing the fires and the koalas. And I want to get down to, I think it's Kangaroo Island. And it's just Australia is awesome. It's just, you guys are great. Love you over the Tassie Sea. Come see me in New Zealand. Okay.
That's right.
But they do have two tree root species there, two of the 14, and then the rest are in New Guinea.
Well, why care about tree root? So that's super easy for me to answer this week. Mm-hmm. First of all, I did not know that there was 14 species. So that was really mind blowing. And then just like you said, thinking about the possibilities that there might be more, they're so poorly studied because of how remote they live. So I just, my whole goal of this podcast today and hopefully throughout this month of showing the tree kangaroo on social media and getting people talking about it is, A, they're a beautiful species, some really cool evolutionary adaptations that we'll talk about. But yeah, they're just really a unique species. And as far as their ecosystem role goes, they are herbivores, and we'll talk a lot about that. They eat leaves and nuts and seeds and things they can get their hands on in the trees. But because of that, being a tree dweller, they play a huge role as a seed disperser in the jungles that they live in, right? So the other thing that's really important to mention with tree kangaroos is that they're an indicator species. So because they have a super specific habitat requirement, as Chris mentioned, they live in different parts of New Guinea, Papua New Guinea, and then and Northern Australia, but wherever they live, because of living in the trees and the different plants and tree species that they eat, they live in this like mountainous, beautiful jungle, tropical forest-like area. And so the health of the tree kangaroo species is an indicator of the health of the overall ecosystem. And unfortunately, overall, Chris can probably speak a little bit more about all the species, but I know with the Machi's tree kangaroo, that population, even with all the people working to fight for them and working on saving them, it is still declining. So that's an indicator that a lot of plant and insect and mammals and birds and reptiles in that area probably aren't doing that great as well. And then when you think of Papua New Guinea, there's a lot of cultural significance of tree kangaroos. So the indigenous population of New Guinea and Papua New Guinea, it's actually referred to as a Boongari. So working to protect the tree kangaroo is also preserving the cultural heritage of all the local communities in that area. And then I touched on this a little bit, but what really struck me, and Chris, I know you can nerd out about this, but being from this region, there's so much unique biodiversity. So the tree kangaroo is just one of several awesome, unique, found only there in the world species. And it's incredible. They can go up to like 11,000 feet and live happily and live in trees and do what they do. But they're not alone. There's tons, like I said, as an indicator species, there's so much other wildlife and plant species that are only found there in the world. I mean, it's just this amazing mega diversity area. It's like one article I was reading described it as an ancient species engine for really important world relevant wildlife and plant populations. And some of them we probably obviously haven't even classified yet. So I just think it's a cool part of the world. It's just a biodiverse hotspot, and we need to save it.
So Papua New Guinea it is. We'll be going there instead of Africa and Australia.
Yes, that is. We don't even need the social media poll. I just sold myself, yourself. John's not listening, but I'll tell him about it later, and I think he'll agree.
Yeah, so it is. It is. I mean, it is Papua New Guinea, and the bird species there are just incredible. The forests, they're so critical, and as this country or this, you know, the island plus Indonesia too. As these tropical forests are being mowed down for palm oil, because that's one of the drivers of these tree kangaroos going to extinction, they're just so important. So it just gets me thinking because, you know, last week we were talking about, a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about me traveling and I'm carbon credits. That's kind of a boondoggle. I don't know how those are really helping the world, but donating to organizations that are, you know, building more sustainable ovens for people in Ecuador, where that has an impact on climate change. I'd rather, you know, that is my trying to offset my carbon. That's what I'm doing with my dollars, right?
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Because, so when I was thinking about it last week, a couple weeks ago, we talked about polar bears again, and it was a revisit to our episode 9, I think it was. So if you haven't heard that, that is a brand new look at polar bears. And I know we talk about climate change and their impacts on the poles. We know that. We know it's a big thing, but I keep going, okay, what about the tropics? And I was just in Queensland. It was incredibly hot. I mean, we're suffering from El Nino. It was suffering. It was Florida heat with no air conditioning, right? Like outside, like I know in Florida back in the day, we were always inside. you know, where it was cool, rush to your car, you'd be drenched in sweat, get in your car, turn on your AC, drive down the road, go home, you have AC again. In Queensland, I mean, they have AC in Queensland, but it just wasn't as much, and it just felt suffering. And maybe because I've been living in New Zealand for so long. But it got me thinking, that's Queensland. That's semi-tropical. That's not even near the equator, right? It's not.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Imagine the peoples, this is a big concern, the peoples living on the equator that don't have air conditioning in Africa, parts of Asia, you know, South America or Central America, where it does get 100, 110, 120 degrees Fahrenheit or close to 40, 45 degrees Celsius. Those peoples are going to suffer mightily because they can't cool off. What about the animals? And this, I did a little bit of digging, and some of the research is saying these tropical species like tree roos are racing to higher elevations to escape the heat. Mm-hmm. And I know we talked about it in the pika, I'm pretty sure, and that was like 200 something episodes ago, because I read a book and it was talking about plant species, how plant species are trying to migrate up mountainsides because it's too hot, and then they can't germinate and they can't flower, and so they're finding the seeds are finding higher elevation where it's the more appropriate temperature. I talked about Joshua tree in California, the Joshua trees in the deserts there. The young plants die off because it's too hot. The older plants have established root systems. They have reserves. These heat waves roll through the deserts of the United States, and all the young Joshua trees are dying out, and that they're projecting that Joshua trees will go extinct in California, Nevada. There's only probably a population in Utah that will survive that's in elevation.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the science is showing that tropical species are shifting their ranges 2 to 2.5 times faster than their other counterparts. The tropical forests are heating up so much that they have to migrate quicker because it's so hot for them. Okay. Say versus, and I always go back to your neck of the woods, Angie, back in the Americas, the moose. We know the moose are going extinct in the lower 48 states because it's too hot. We're your hometown of Michigan. It's too hot for them. They can't cool off. 100 degrees. It was over 86, I think you said. They don't sweat. They go stick their hooves in cold water to cool off, or they have those dew laps or whatever. And when northern Canada is experiencing 100 degrees Fahrenheit, 38, 39 degrees Celsius,
right,
the moose can't survive. Right? They have nowhere to go. So, you know, just to kind of tie it up, just because climate change affects the poles more so, it doesn't mean it's not affecting species around the equator like the tree roos. And they're losing their habitats. And for those that are surviving, the scientists talk about it as like an arms race. They're going up the mountains. And I don't know so much tree roos. We don't have data on them because like, you can't really get to some of these parts of Papua New Guinea. But for some of these species that they're studying, like the pika, other ones, that mountain's only so tall. And the temperature will catch up. And then where do they go?
Right.
They go extinct. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's just something we need to all think about. We need to mitigate carbon. We need to vote green. And there is good news. There always is good news. There's people fighting for them. There's these scientists out there studying this, raising the red flags.
Yes. I secured a really awesome interview about tree kangaroos that should be dropping within a few weeks. So yeah, I'm very excited about that. Well, prepping for tree kangaroos, of course, I have my husband and we're always talking about these things. And he's like, well, I know a gal. So he's awesome. Yeah. He hooked me up. And we're going to learn a lot more about what the tree conservationists are doing to help save them.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. For sure. All right. It's a good spot for a break. Angie, I did find the largest kangaroo in history. I don't know if I brought this up before.
I can't wait.
Yeah. Yeah. We were talking about the wombat. God, that was the size of a tank. oh God, I could only imagine what that looked like walking around. But I did find the largest kangaroo. So we'll talk about that after the break. And I just always love marsupial evolution and then get into what really makes a tree kangaroo a kangaroo. So stay tuned for that. All right, welcome back. Evolution of marsupials. We had quokkas last week. Loved them. Saw them in Queensland at the zoo.
I know your zoo. Photos. I was so stoked when I got those.
I know. I want to go see them over in Perth. But again, these are mammals. Marsupials are mammals. You know, thousands of species, plenty to cover for us. The marsupials, specifically around 334 species, maybe more being added. 70% live in Australia and then New Guinea and islands like that. The other 30% of marsupials live in South America. So at some point this year, we'll cover one there.
Yeah, 13 that's species, exciting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 13 species in Central America and then only one species in North America. The Virginia possum.
I was going to say, do you have the episode? Okay.
Well, episode 169. Yeah, I had it. So
yes,
yeah, marsupials are awesome.
Possums are the best.
Yeah.
They eat ticks in your backyard. Don't get rid of them. They are very helpful to your local environment.
Yeah, I saw one creeping along the fence in California when I was there in September last year. So tree roos, specifically the order is Diprotentia. And this is the largest order of marsupials, 155 species. You have your wombats in there, your koalas, your possums. Possums, not opossums. These are Australia possums. We have them here in New Zealand. They are invasive. Oh, they're so cute, though. Wallabies and kangaroos. The family, like Angie says, is Macropodiae. So these, again, are your roos. These are all, and the quokkas are in there, too. Little quokkas.
Fun.
And then the genus Dendrolagus. The 14 species, don't have to go through all the scientific names. We'll be here all day. But the Bennets I talked about, the Dorlas, the Goodfellows, the Grizzled, the Golden Mantle Tree Kangaroo, that's the one they just found. And then you had some others, right?
Yes. I love the Tin Kyle, also known as Scott's Tree Kangaroo. It's beautiful. It's much blacker in color. Really pretty tree kangaroo. And then, interestingly enough, the one that you mentioned, the Wandowi wheat. Okay, hold on. The Wandi Woe. I'm probably saying that wrong. The Wandi Woe tree kangaroo is critically endangered. It was thought to be extinct until it was rediscovered in 2018. Just some beautiful, and the Godfellows you mentioned, that's just a really pretty tree kangaroo as well. Looks a lot like the Matchies. They're such a fun, cool species. I just didn't know there were so many of them. And as you mentioned, that one we thought was extinct, right? And there, it turns out that's some good news, some good conservation news. But it just goes to show that there's a lot of data deficient, as you mentioned earlier, with the IUCN because of where they live. And I want to know more about them. I want people to be able to study them in the wild. I was reading from different researchers. They were like, spotting one in the wild is like the holy grail because they're high in trees and they are very elusive, right? It's very rare to spot them in the wild, but the feeling is pretty incredible.
Yeah. Well, what I love about the evolution of marsupials is how they started in North America, migrated to South America, and then lived in Antarctica 55 million years ago, 60 million years ago, you know, after the Earth was recovering from the asteroid or whatever that went into the Yucatan Peninsula, the fifth mass extinction. Then they went into Australia. And then that was when Australia, around this time, 50, 55 million years ago, started moving north, right? Zealandia, that was where I'm living now. That was part of that. And most of the marsupials got isolated there, where the other ones in the Americas have evolved. But marsupials go back to the earliest mammals, you know, 210 million years ago, roughly shrew-like animals living next to dinosaurs, but suppressed earliest mammals. And then about 125 million years ago is when marsupials split from our early mammal ancestors. And then they went on this Antarctica Australian onboard landmass where they were, you know, migrating across. And then once, you know, Australia broke off and started migrating north, the continent, and they got isolated and became all these rich, abundant species that we see today in Australia. And then about 35 million years ago is when Antarctica started to freeze over. So whatever animals were stuck down there went extinct. I can only imagine the fossils there, but I don't know anybody that's looking for fossils in Antarctica. There might be somebody, but not many people live on Antarctica, scientists. What we know about tree roots specifically, about 35 million years ago, you had this period of drying, and so Australia, New Guinea linked, and there was some gene flow, right, of these animals that lived there. They think rock wallabies are kind of like the closer for tree roots, and then they went to the trees about 6-7 million years ago. And they were kind of surviving up in these trees. And I really want, maybe the rock wallaby would be a good one we can do. I know there's some really critically endangered species there. It was about 2-3 million years ago where these species of tree kangaroos emerged. So they're older, you know, definitely like you said, New Guinea. I don't know, whenever I think of like these movies of King Kong or, you know, these remote places on yeah. Earth where they go find these incredible animals. That's kind of how I see New Guinea. So I really hope to get up there here in a few months. But yeah, so old species, and that's about what we know. You know, about 2 million years old, maybe 3 million years old of all these tree kangaroos.
Wow, and that's just, I mean, it just gets back to, as we were talking about earlier, that Papua New Guinea is just this mega diversity nation with ancient species. It's just incredible. But they're still very relevant today and important to conserve, right?
Yeah. Well, before we get to some fun facts, I did want to talk about the giant kangaroo or the giant short-faced kangaroo called the Goliath. How tall? It's not the giant rhino. So
no. But I think of like the giant sloth bear that was here in Florida locally many, many years ago.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. Taller than you standing up.
Yes, a little bit.
I was gonna say 8 feet.
Yeah, good. Yeah, 8.2 feet tall.
Thank you.
About 530 pounds. It
was okay, that's a lot.
Yeah, it lived in the Pleistocene, so yeah, 2 million years ago, a million years ago. Very large kangaroo. Where today, the red kangaroos, not quite 6 feet tall, males, you know, they're big. But not 8 feet tall giants with the giant wombats the size of tanks that used to live, and the giant crocs that were like 30, 40 feet long. Good old Australia.
Somebody needs to make that movie. They need to make that movie.
I know.
I would pay to see it on the big screen. That's for sure.
I know. Oh, all these crazy species that lived so long ago. Tree roots. Let's talk about life cycle. Up to 20 years, that's pretty common for a lot of these species. Oldest under human care, 27 years. Definitely not the fastest animal on the ground. They're not meant to be fast. They're tree roos. They live up in the trees. I saw hopping around like 5 kilometers an hour. So not very, they don't have a very clean gait. I mean, you watch them at the zoo, right? When they move around, it's just, they're supposed to live in the trees.
Yeah, they amble on the ground. Yeah, I mean, and I almost always see them up in the trees. I mean, it's very, very rare to see them on the ground.
Yeah, like a sloth. I was trying to remember the sloth is the latrine.
I'll have to ask the zookeepers. Did they come down to go to the bathroom or not? That's a good husbandry question. I don't know.
Oh, God, I should probably re-release that episode. Sloths are so crazy. It's so fun. This was something I didn't know. Tree kangaroos are the only kangaroos that can walk on their hind feet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they have huge adaptations for climbing in the trees. Right? You look at their feet. I mean, those claws are pretty intense. They'd have to be.
Yeah, because the tree kangaroos have really powerful forelimbs. And then, of course, their hind limbs also help them be very agile climbers. And their feet, as you mentioned, are very, very well adapted for gripping onto branches and tree trunks.
and these long curved claws. I mean, their claws are no joke, but they, of course, help provide traction in digging into the trees. And what's really interesting, too, with tree kangaroos is they have this specialized ankle joint that allows for both, like you said, forward and backward movement. And so that is going to help them when they're climbing from tree to tree and leaping between branches. So they do go from branch to branch, and obviously not probably as graceful as a monkey or maybe a squirrel that we're used to looking at here in North America, but they can jump from branch to branch. It's just not as graceful. But these this special ankle or tarsal joint helps allow for them to move in between the trees. And what I learned too, Chris, when I was studying for this, is that the Machi's tree kangaroo is actually the best vertical climber and has more strength for doing this than a lot of the other species of tree kangaroos. So they are, when we think of tree kangaroos climbing and strong, the Machi's is just like the number one. And then, of course, their tail is long, right? And it's a prehensile tail, so they can, for the most part, it doesn't wrap around several times, but they can help use it to balance when they're moving through the trees. And they're basically, their tail is about the same length of their body, more or less. And so it really helps to like counterbalance them when they land and when they are going up and down. And although they're no kangaroo as far as their jumping abilities, when it's necessary, they can jump like down to like another tree branch as much as like 18 meters, 30 feet without injury. So, and that's where then their landing with those ankles helps them and all that. So while we don't think of tree kangaroos as jumpers like their ground dwelling cousin in Australia, they can jump, if you will. I also love too, as far as some of their arboreal adaptations, is their camouflage. And when you look at the different photos of some of the species of tree kangaroos that Chris and I mentioned, they have different coloring from browns to grays to almost like black in color. And a lot of that depends on what region they live in and what trees they need to blend in and how they need to camouflage into the area where they live high up in the trees. So I think that's really a cool adaptation. So depending on the trees where they live and things like that, they can really, really blend in, which once again makes sighting them in the wild such a rare, awesome phenomenon and a great treat if you are a researcher or a local there. So I also mentioned too that they have this thick fur, especially I'm most familiar with the Machi's tree kangaroo because I get to get up close and personal, if you will, with them at the zoo. But they have this basically water protection, and not only the Machi's tree kangaroo, but several of the other species of tree kangaroos have this thick fur that grows in the opposite direction on their neck and back area. It creates almost like a whirl in their hair and their fur, and the thickness of their fur in general and the whorl nature of the pattern of their coat hairs helps them shed water easily when it is raining where they live. So it's a pretty cool little adaptation to help stay dry when you're up in the mountainous cloud forest. Some of them live in what is considered a cloud forest, which I've been blessed enough to go up into the cloud forest of Costa Rica, which is pretty beautiful. Monteverde, I spent some time there, but it's where you really, you're like, it's like raining, but you're like actually in the cloud. It's pretty cool. So having this thick fur really can help with that. And then I think it's really cute if you've ever seen a tree kangaroo go down a tree, they typically back down trees. So that's different than their North American cousin, the opossum here in Florida. The opossums can go down head first, but tree kangaroos will basically shimmy down trees in the reverse direction. But tree kangaroos will kind of shimmy down with their bum first, which makes them even more darling. as they move around. But oftentimes they'll make the decision of whether or not they should leap to the ground. And they will also often descend that way by just jumping down to the ground. Once again, depending on how many meters up it is, and if that's a safe move for them or not. So yeah, they're just super. I mean, they're very agile in the trees. They look very graceful. Mm-hmm. But on the ground, yes, they have this kind of hobbling gait. It's not super beautiful, but they're so darn cute they can get away with it. And from what the studies have shown in general, tree kangaroos, of course, this is varies from species to species. But on average, they do spend a lot of time sleeping, up to 60% of their day, where they curl up in whatever tree they happen to be in and just rest. Yeah. So when I visit the zoo a lot, I usually go in the afternoons. And so it tends to be around feeding time. So Adelaide and her joeys are usually pretty active, which is always nice to see them. But yes, I highly recommend if you have an accredited local zoo in your neighborhood to go check out and see if they have tree kangaroos. There's not a lot at the zoos. Once again, because their numbers are so low in the wild, they're also not very high under human care as well. But man, if you get so lucky to see one, you will definitely fall in love the way that I have.
Well, it's interesting too. I talked about like the only kangaroo that can walk on their hind feet. I mean, most mm-hmm. other kangaroos hop, right. hop. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, to see that the only kangaroo that can walk, even though it's not graceful,
it's still, yeah, it's like an ambling gait. Yeah. It's yeah, fine. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's cute.
So again, an herbivore, mainly eat tree leaves, things like that. They continually graze on that. But they do eat, I mean, there's some fruit. They'll eat some insects, maybe little birds or bird eggs. I read tree sap, bark, things like that. So they do have a varied diet.
Insects again, sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, thinking about it being, as you said, a disperser of seeds. So the fruits and all that stuff and the flowers, very important. Because again, a tropical forest or rainforest needs that manure for the seeds and deposit the seeds, spreads them out. They play a critical role. I mean, just critical role.
And here's the deal, Chris. In the wild of the different species, we probably don't know exactly what they eat, right?
We
have some ideas, of course, the trees that they're hanging out in and stuff, but as far as how much seeds they're dispersing and what trees and fruits would be lost if their populations were completely gone, and how that could influence and negatively change the whole landscape for the forest that they live in. It's pretty crazy. And in general too, when they're not sleeping, the tree kangaroo does eat sporadically throughout the day, usually about for 15-20 minutes, and then then it will rest for a little bit and then eat again. So kind of eat, rest, and repeat. That sounds like my kind of life.
Yeah. Now, when it comes to what preys on them, humans are the main, but they do have birds of prey, snakes that can get them. I imagine maybe some stuff in Australia. I don't know if quolls can get to them or not, but they do have some predators. So not the easiest life, but what other behaviors did you come across with them?
Yeah, and so as far as their social behavior, tree kangaroos in general are not social. So as far as my understanding is that the tree kangaroos in general of the species live alone. And that also includes the matchies. They're solitary except for when they breed. And so at the Santa Fe College Teaching Zoo, they have a male and a female that are a breeding pair based on the species survival plan of the AZA accredited zoos, but they will only live together and be housed together for breeding purposes. Once they've bred, they will be separated, and that's how they like it. Their natural history. They don't want to be together unless it is when they're breeding. So it's thought that with the matchies in the wild, the territory size of the female is about 4 to 5 acres. While male can claim more than double that, up to 11 acres. So, I mean, that's when you think of a forested area that needs to be protected for just one tree kangaroo, that's 11 acres. So that's, I mean, that's a fairly large chunk. But when we talk about the tree kangaroo as an indicator and an umbrella species is, okay, I want to save this, yeah, this plot of land that's 100 acres. I mean, it could possibly house 8 or 9 males, right? So, and along with that, how many trees would it be saving? How many smaller reptiles and birds? You know, you're the bird guy. So it is, you know, they really, they're obviously a bold and beautiful and intriguing creature, but they can also potentially help save lots of other species too by fighting for them. So, and then of course during breeding season with my 100-acre example, which I don't know what that is in hectares, and that makes me a bad person. So I apologize for our non-American listeners. I promise I'll get better at my conversions. Of course, during breeding season, a male will need more territory. Just how much? I don't think the research is there on that. Obviously, we want to always overestimate when we're trying to save land for species. But it, his territory does get bigger. And as far as vocalizations go, I actually asked John because the literature, there wasn't a ton of literature on tree kangaroo vocalizations. But he said not very vocal at all, unlike the lemurs. You go to the zoo, or the gibbons, always singing. But tree kangaroos will make grunts, hissing noises, sometimes a little bit of growling, chattering. Once again, that's going to be more related to one another. And since they're not a super social animal, they don't really need to vocally communicate that often, of course. And so, yeah, in general, not a super vocal animal. So if a tree kangaroo is vocalizing, probably mean really it means something, right? It's like it's trying to express something to either the other tree kangaroo or to the human caretaker. But it is known too that there's definitely a lot of probably chemical communication that happens between male and female, especially during breeding season, right? So they can find each other, and so the male can know which if the female is receptive or in estrus. So there's a good chance that they're using their smell a lot more than we fully understand, just because the species hasn't been as well studied as several others.
Now, being along the equator, so what's the breeding season? How does that impact them?
Ah, great question, Chris. As far as the Matchey's tree kangaroo, they are polyestrous, so they do have multiple estrous cycles within a year. But there is no defined breeding season. And that probably does have something to do with being right along the equator, right? Once again, there's an understudied species as far as the reproductive health and things like that, just because of where they live. However, I was able to find several good high-quality papers from behavioral and reproductive research being done in zoos when they're housed under human care. So that's really helpful to know that information when researchers and conservationists are trying to save the forest that they live in, to understand how all this stuff works out. So there has been some report of low breeding rates, so low copulation rates between October and March. And that's under human care. But once again, it's just hard to relate that back to the wild. But what we do know about Matchey's tree kangaroos and the reproduction, and once again, this is going to vary from species to species of tree kangaroo, but with the Matchey's, they will come into estrus when observed under human care anywhere from 51 to 79 days. So not as much as like horses or humans, but more so than like dogs, who are typically monoestrus, so only one estrus cycle or so per year. So about every 60 days or so, the female will be high estrogen and receptive to a male, and will be interested in his courtship behaviors. And when a female is in estrus and if a male is around that she has interest in, she will descend to the ground and approach the male. And then they will actually make some vocalizations. Now, I couldn't find any videos on this. And so all my zookeeper friends, if you have any of this courtship of tree kangaroos on film, let me know. This is so cool. Because what the literature suggests is that the male and female, when they're on the ground approaching each other, and they contact each other and they start tongue clicking and hissing. So they will make some vocalizations. And then, of course, the female will probably swat at the male. Good for her. But if she's still interested in him and he plays his cards right, she will allow him to breed her. So copulation is actually on the ground. So I was curious about that with some of our arboreal species, where does that occur? But with the tree kangaroo, at least with the matchies, we know that that happens on the ground, and breeding will actually take place for about an hour or so. And when I was talking this over with my husband, yes, that's how big of nerds we are. We had to go over my tree kangaroo reproduction notes with him late at night when we're bored. But no, I had to ask him the question because in the literature, they talk about the matchy's tree kangaroo and leaving a seminal plug. So if you have underage listeners, this might go in a little bit deeper into physiology because it's actually, Chris, something that I was super fascinated with. I don't know if you and I have ever talked about a semen plug or plug.
Maybe once or twice. We've been paring down the repro talk for the little ones, but yeah, no, it's interesting. Yeah, how some species do that. Yeah, to protect their genetics, right? As a male.
Yeah, that's what of course, evolutionary biologists, they always have to guess when they see some physiology and they don't always have the best answer. But yeah, I mean, basically the semen plug is just a portion of the seminal plaza that's thicker and kind of coagulates. And so, yeah, they think it's probably because a female matchy's tree kangaroo, in case she does breed with another male, that way, the first male will have a more likelihood that he will indeed be the father. And so I just thought it was really interesting. And I did nerd out with John about a semen plug and what chemicals are made, how is it made, and what species do it. Mm-hmm. And it's not uncommon. My husband was telling me, too, that when they are putting male and female together, that is actually something that they may look for as from a husbandry perspective. To basically know if copulation happened because they may not copulate, of course, when zookeepers are around. So yeah, anyways, I just thought that was really fascinating. And after a male does breed a female tree kangaroo, in the matchy's tree kangaroo, gestation is anywhere from about 39 to 45 days. And what's so cool, Chris, is this is the longest gestation period for any marsupial.
Yeah, I saw that.
Longer than our ground dwelling kangaroos in Australia or our opossums here in North America. So yeah, pretty cool. And when a female is about to give birth, she'll typically isolate herself if she is housed with another male at the time or something. And her birth position is she sits on the base of the tail, her tail, with her tail between her legs. So that's an interesting birth position that they've recorded in the literature. And yeah, after about 2 minutes, a little tiny itsy bitsy Joey, less than 1 inch, is born vaginally, of course. And then I used to always love to talk about this fact in my kangaroo talk that I would give as a zookeeper for the red kangaroos, because it's just so fascinating. I mean, 1 inch. So that's what, the size of a jelly bean, if you will?
Yeah, tiny. Yep.
Tiny, underdeveloped. It has like little arm buds and its eyes are closed. And it basically crawls from the birth canal of the female. A very long journey, if you're only an inch long, up and then down and into the pouch of Mama Matchy's tree kangaroo. And when they're doing this, this little 1 inch jelly bean sized baby, they're blind, they're hairless. Once again, they're pink. I mean, they just must use scent cues to just figure out how to do that. And it's just so fascinating to me as a physiologist that the instinct and the cues to do that. I mean, we're all born with instincts, of course. But this is like the little Joey jelly bean is so underdeveloped, right? It's just mm-hmm. fascinating. And once the Joey gets into the mother's pouch for the tree kangaroo, it will attach to one of her four nipples, and then it'll stay there for a long time. In fact, this is definitely different than some of the other marsupials we've talked about, Chris, because a Joey tree kangaroo, or the Matchies, for example, will be about 250 days old before it even pops its little head out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so fun whenever this happens at the zoo because, once again, they'll put the male and female, they'll know when the female's in estrus, they'll put male and female together, they may or may not find a plug. And then it's like this waiting game, but it's not just like the gestation of like 40 days. It's up to like 250 plus before they may or may not see a little head pop out of that pouch. And it's always so cool. I'll hear it on John's radio when I'm visiting or something. They'll be like, tree kangaroo, Joey sighting, tree kangaroo, Joey. Like, but they almost had to prove it, like for the curator, like, no, we need to see a picture. Are you seeing things? Because you want to see it or. this is an endangered species, right? Every birth of Matchie's tree kangaroo within the SSB of the North American Zoos is extremely, extremely important for their population. And so the Joey stays in the pouch for a long time. And it probably won't even like think about leaving the pouch even for a hot second until it's about 300 days old. That's almost a year.
Yeah, it's long. It's really long for them. Yep.
That's almost a year. And so that's why, for all my fellow tree kangaroo keepers out there, it is a big deal. It's much different than, I think, when you're a kangaroo keeper because the Joeys present themselves much sooner. So very, very hidden, mysterious little Joeys hang out in those pouches at least for about 10 months, maybe hiding themselves. And then interestingly enough, the average weaning age is about 12 months for a Matchie's tree kangaroo. So these are really good moms. And they're not going to breed every year, right? Because that's a lot of energy to put into one Joey. And there's only one, right? So the weaned Joey typically really in the wild wouldn't leave its mother until it's about 18 months old. So, I mean, female Matchie's tree kangaroos, and I would assume other species of tree kangaroos, they really nurse their young for a long, long period of time. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about generation intervals and like helping this population or all these populations of tree kangaroos rebound, it's not going to be super quick because of that. And what's super fascinating is tree kangaroos typically on average for the different species don't reach their sexual maturity until they're like at least 2 years old. And they may, depending on what species they are, they may be reproductively active till they're about 10 or 12. So it's not a lot of offspring to pass your genetics off to. For any nursing mother out there knows that that's a lot of energy to put into an offspring. So when it happens at the zoo, every other year or so, it's like a miracle. It's really fun. So, and unfortunately for social media, there was a Joey that was, I think probably about a year and a half. And so it, moved on to another home where it can help pass on its genetics when it gets older. So no Joeys or teenage Joeys right now at the Santa Fe College Teaching Zoo, but we'll keep you updated on social media when there is another one. It's very exciting.
Yeah, I can only imagine. And I mean, like when you go down the list, it doesn't look good. It doesn't. The Bennett's is near threatened. The Dingslow, vulnerable. Dorla's near threatened. Goodfellow's vulnerable. Grizzled Tree is least concerned. Lumholtz is least concerned. Then the Matchkey's endangered.
Yeah, the Golden Mantle. I have a lot of them as endangered.
Critically endangered. Yeah, there are. The Golden Mantled is critically endangered. About 500 left. So all herding and
yeah, the scats, tree kangaroo, the really pretty black one that I mentioned, critically endangered, less than maybe 250.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
And the Machi's tree kangaroo, I mean, once again, I mean, population estimates vary, but in general, there's thought to be about 2,500 and endangered, most literature says. So
Well, if you want to help a tree roo, do you have your water bottles? Do you have your coffee cups, reusables? It's a habit for me now. I hope most people today in 2024 has reusable water bottles. You know, it's one way to help climate change. We talked about carbon credits or what I'm doing as far as travel. There's different things we can do. Just take these and make them habits. Shut your water off, all of that can help the planet. But who's fighting for tree roos? I mean, which organizations you highlight today?
Yeah, so I want to give a big shout out to the Tree Kangaroo Conservation Program, TKCP. It's based out of Woodland Park Zoo in Seattle, Washington, and they focus their conservation efforts for tree kangaroos in Papua New Guinea. And they work with local communities to promote conservation awareness, conduct research, and of course, implement habit protection initiatives. And excitingly enough, I'm going to talk to the woman that is the lead of this program. So we'll get more information. So I'll have to look forward to the episode dropping in the next couple of weeks. I'm very, very excited to learn more because I have a lot of questions that I hope to get answered. And also to know that there is a good team of conservationists fighting for them is very hopeful. So if you want to learn more about the Tree Kangaroo Conservation Program, you can follow them at the Tree Kangaroo Conservation Program on Facebook. They have a lovely Facebook page. And you can also learn more about this organization at www.zoo.org/TKCP. So to all of our listeners out in Seattle, also I would highly recommend supporting the Woodland Park Zoo. It's a great, great zoo that is doing amazing conservation work. And this is just one of the examples of that. So the other group I want to give a shout out to is more international and over in Papua New Guinea. And that is the Ten Kyle Conservation Alliance. So the Ten Kyle or the Scots tree kangaroo that I mentioned, there was a couple hundred left, that really pretty blackish one. The Ten Kyle Conservation Alliance is dedicated to the conservation of the critically endangered Ten Kyle tree kangaroo or Scots tree kangaroo and other threatened species in Papua New Guinea. So the TCA, Ten Kyle Conservation Alliance, works with local communities to establish conservation areas, conduct research, and once again, figure out how to sustainably manage the land that they share with these species. So you can find more about their organization at www.tenkyle.com. That's TENKILE.com. And of course, we'll post all of this on our show notes as well. So there's a couple great organizations in Australia also fighting for the Goodfellows and a couple others. So it was hopeful for me to know that there are several groups internationally and abroad and then even here in the U.S. that understand how serious this fight is to save the tree kangaroo and all the different species in the land that they live on. So, and of course, a great way to show them support is by following them on social media, sharing their information, liking their information, just getting the word out, right? This may be the first time you've heard of a tree kangaroo, and trust me, Chris and I have been doing this for a long time, and there were still several facts that I learned this week that blew my mind, right? Like, I didn't know that, so I had no idea there were that many species. I didn't know that they were that endangered, unfortunately. So, we got to get the word out there. And that's what our community on this podcast does a great job of doing. So I want to thank all of our listeners for doing that for sure.
Yeah. If you're listening at this point, thank you. I mean, just thank you. Thank you.
We love you.
Much. Yeah. No, thank you.
So do tree kangaroos.
Yeah. 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 You're a conservation hero and we really appreciate it. Working hard. Angie and I've got a slate of interviews scheduled. So start looking for those. And again, for your conservation, if you want to make that a career, reach out to Angie and I, allcreaturespod@gmail.com. Like I said, Abigail and I had a great discussion trying to help her in her career. But We're here for you, and we will do everything we can to keep growing this community. So thank you for listening, and stay tuned. We got another great species coming your way.
Listen, learn, share. Join the movement at allcreaturespod.com.